Drama on One.
Sundays at 8 p.m.
rte.ie/drama on one.
Drama on One.
Janice Ian.
Well, you know, I think one of the great things and the great privileges of being an artist is that you get to hold people's memories and give them back to them in a way that perhaps they couldn't have expressed themselves years maybe after those memories have faded for them. And this song is one of those songs. I learned the truth at 17, that love was meant for beauty queens and high school girls with clear-skinned smiles who married young and then retired. The Valentines I never knew, the Friday night charades of youth were spent on one more beautiful. At 17 I learned the truth. And those of us with ravaged faces, lacking in the social graces, desperately remained at home, inventing lovers on the phone, who called to say, come dance with me, and murmured vague obscenities. It isn't all it seems at 17. A brown-eyed girl in hand-me-downs, whose name I never could pronounce, said, pity please the ones who serve, 'cause they only get what they deserve. Relationed hometown queen marries into what she needs with a guarantee of company, and haven for the elderly. So remember those who win the game, lose the love they sought to gain, in debentures of quality and dubious integrity. Their small town eyes will gape at you in dull surprise when payment due exceeds accounts received at 17. Those of us who knew the pain of Valentines that never came, and those whose names were never called when choosing sites for basketball, it was long ago and far away, and the world was younger than today, when dreams were all they gave for free to ugly duckling girls like me. We all play the game, and when we dare, we cheat ourselves at solitaire, inventing lovers on the phone, repenting other lives unknown. Call and say, come on, dance with me, and murmur vague obscenities at ugly girls like me at 17.
For years, Janice Ian, I listened to that on a CD player various bedsits and various houses that I lived in over the years. I never really thought I'd get a chance to sit across a table from you and hear you play it for me like that.
That's pretty cool, isn't it?
It's more than cool.
It's one of the cool things about being an artist. You know, I sometimes turn to everybody I work with after, you know, I stay after every show and I sign things and I meet people. And I always say, you don't have to buy anything just to come up and say hello. But sometimes people are so happy by it, you know. And I turned to my staff the other day and I said, look at that. You know, I mean, that cost us so little. And those people went away so happy. It's a cool thing.
But it costs you your spirit to give that out. I know it's great to share the
spirit.
Well,
we've thought of charging for it, but, you know.
How have you retained the teenage spirit? Because it's still audible to me when you sing.
I don't think that ever goes away. You know, I mean, I remember a friend of mine who was a nun. She was in her 70s, and I was asking her what that was like. And she said, well, you know, it was always a shock when she looked in the mirror because in her mind, she was always 16. And the mirror person wasn't nearly as familiar to her as the 16-year-old inside. So I don't think that it ever leaves.
And as you sing that song, which, I mean, I was speaking to a colleague today and I mentioned that you were going to be on the programme, and they said, they didn't even say 17, they just said, you know, that song makes me cry every time I hear it. They didn't even have to say what the song was.
That's great.
As you sing it now, whatever, 30, 40 years on, what sort of memories flow into your head?
A great deal of gratitude that I'm no longer 17. Really, because I think it's just an absolutely miserable age for anybody. You know, you're old enough to be called to account and you're too young to do so many things, and yet you're supposed to behave like you are old enough to be able to be called to account. And the peer pressure and everything is just horrendous, and you're not allowed to talk about how miserable you are, you know, so you invent all other things to be miserable about. It's just horrible.
You tell a lovely story on the Janice Ian Live album, Working Without Annette. Recently, I was listening to that over the last couple of days as well.
You're frightening me with how much homework you've done here.
It's easy to do when it's that enjoyable.
Nah.
You tell a lovely story about when you first presented this song to your mother, worried about what was she going to think about this younger than 17 when you wrote it. Think about this teenager who was presenting her with this song. You thought you were exposing yourself.
I did very much feel like I was exposing myself, and it was a hard time for me because I couldn't get a record contract, I couldn't get a publishing contract, and I was living with my mother again, which nobody wants to do when they're 22. And she kept saying, it's all right, you know, I want to support your work. And I kept saying, no, it's not all right, I feel like crap. But I wrote the song and I said, you want to hear a new song? And she said, of course. And I played it with my eyes closed because I just found it so humiliating to sing and to expose myself that way. And at the end, I was looking somewhere else and I said, you know, I'm thinking it's a pretty good song, but I'm never going to sing it live because it's just too embarrassing. And I looked at my mom and she was crying. And I said, what are you crying for? And she said, that's my song. And I said, I mean, I'd seen her high school pictures. And I said, how can that be your song? You were beautiful. And she said, that is my song. And I thought, wow, if somebody who was beautiful in high school feels that way, then the rest of us must as well.
I want to talk to you about the new album as well, because that's another reason that
you make my record company happy as well.
Billy's Bones. Now, anybody who half knows you will know who Billy is, I would guess.
I would think, but for those who don't, it's Billie Holiday, who's just, to me, the best female singer of the last 100 years, and somebody that whose work I go to before every album just to listen for 2 months and make sure that I'm on the right track as a singer. And she's who I've always aspired to, not to sing like, but to have the dignity of her voice and the amount of truth in her voice.
And yet as a role model, many people would think...
She's a wretched role model. Absolutely. I mean, all those jazz women, just horrible, you know. And Bessie Smith used to beat people up, you know. Ma Rainey knifed a guy and they all came out of the bordellos and half of them were hookers before they became singers. But wretched role models. But as artists, if you separate the person from the artist, which we all have to do once we start meeting artists because so many artists are complete idiots unless they're doing their art. If you separate the person from the art, Billy is just astonishing. Just astonishing.
Did it annoy you when that confusion was made in your own life, when 17 was one of the songs that was taken, and when you were out it in the 70s and people said, oh, so it wasn't about a teenage heartbreak with a young fella at all? Did that annoy you?
No, because it was never about any heartbreak with any fellow, I mean, or woman or anybody. You know, there's not even a dog in there. I feel like once I've written a song, it's out of my hands. And if somebody wants to interpret it a certain way, that's their business. That's why I rarely talk about what the songs mean to me, because I think it takes it away from the audience.
This album, Billy's Bones, Billie Holiday, the big hero within it. There's a poem at the back of the CD notes as well. That's been there for quite a while.
It has. I wrote that when I was 15 or 16, and it was to go in a book of poetry called Who Really Cares? And the publishers decided that it was too inflammatory. And I didn't understand it then, and I don't understand it now, but I thought, well, here's my revenge.
And how long do you keep material? How long is stuff like that in gestation? You clearly weren't aware when you wrote that poem back in your teenage years that, oh, and come 2003, I'll write a song out of it.
No, you know, I had the idea for a song about Billie Holiday, and there was something niggling at the back of my mind, and I kept thinking, I'm sure I've already written something about her. And I started going back through my old notebooks from when I was a kid, and there it was, and I thought, right, that's exactly what I want to say now. That I keep trying and trying and trying. And I know I'll never get there, but the dignity is in the trying, really.
And a song like 17, are you asked everywhere you go?
No, I sing it first before they have to ask. I just preempt it. You know, I don't mind singing it. I love that song. I think that's a wonderful, speaking as someone who wrote it 25 years ago, it's a wonderful song, and it gives people a way to bond. I see mothers bringing their daughters, fathers bringing their sons, and when the kid realizes that their parent felt that way too, it gives them common ground that's all too difficult at that age to find. So it's a great thing to have written something that people remember that highly and that fondly.
And it still amazes me that, I mean, what age were you when you wrote that? 14?
At 20, no, at 17 I was 24, 23. Mm. I think you need some distance to write about that.
So you were looking back.
Yeah, I mean, if I'd had to write about it in the middle of it, it'd probably be called... You know, at 17, I hated everybody, and you included, you know.
But the songwriting did start as early as 13 and 14.
Yeah, I had my first song published when I was 12. And Society's Child, my first hit in the States when I was 14, 15. But I don't think I became a good songwriter till really my 20s, you know, a consistent songwriter. It takes time to grow up, you know.
And, I mean, the sort of Society's Child has teenage anger in it that maybe 17 doesn't have.
Well, I think at 17, I was, you know, by the time I was 25, I was sort of resigned to my face. I wasn't going to wake up one morning tall and blonde with straight hair, and God wasn't going to grant me any miracles. Whereas with Society's Child, I didn't really care about miracles.
We've had 17. Let's hear something from the new album. Tell us where this one came from, because I think listeners will be very interested in the inspiration.
I was on tour with Mary Black for 6 weeks, and it was fantastic. I mean, she's just great. And her band were lovely. She had her 7-year-old daughter at the time, Rasheen, with her, and she was starting to teach her Irish history. And I'm Jewish, and we very much see our history as a continuum. And it was amazing to hear Mary talking about Irish history as a continuum as well. Then right at the end of that, I came to Dublin to play the National and had 2 days off, which is unheard of on the road. And I spent them sitting in a window seat in my little hotel room overlooking the roofs of Dublin and watching the cats have this whole mysterious cat life in Dublin. I don't know what, Dublin cats just seemed very different from anywhere else. And I did something I never do on the road, and I wrote a song, and this is the song. Mary's eyes are startling blue, and her hair's Newcastle gold, and she walks the fine white line between the body and the soul. She's as faithful to her history as a novice to his fast, for she stands upon the bones of Ireland's past. She is singing of the troubles and a fire in the land, till I can almost feel the famine slipping through my trembling hand. And I wonder as I hear her how the spirit still shines through, and she can reach across the ocean deep and break my heart into. Mary's wise as she is foolish. She's as constant as the tide. It's a woman's heart that beats beneath that stubborn Irish pride. We are saints and we are sinners. We are heroes, we are thieves. But we are all of us beginners on the road to Galilee. We are singing of our troubles and the fire in the land, till I can almost feel the famine slipping through my trembling hand. And I wonder as I hear her how the Spirit still shines through, and she can reach across the ocean deep and break my heart into the So let us hoist a pint of silence to the east where Ireland lies, and we'll gaze across the waters for a glimpse of Mary's eyes. We are ships without a harbor. We are sailors on dry land. And the song goes on forever, even though the record can't. We are singing of the troubles and of fire in the land, till I can almost feel the famine slipping through my trembling hand. And I wonder as I hear her how the Spirit still shines through, and she can reach across the ocean deep and break my heart in two.
Mary's Eyes from the new album Billy's Bones, Janicene. Thank you very much for that.
You're so welcome.
I'm sure that Mary would be very happy to hear it too. I don't know if you're aware of it, but every time you spoke about Mary's eyes smiling,
did
an
I
enormous
up?
Smile came across your face.
Well, you know, I love working with other artists. I really do. And I think it's one of the great perks of my job that I get to meet people that I admire, be it Mary or the Ab Fab Girls or Chick Corea or Chet Atkins. You know, it's just... it's a wonderful perk.
You're here just you and the guitar in the studio today, but the album then, it's not just you.
No, the album is a band album with Mary's Eyes and I Hear You Sing Again. It's I tried to set a middle ground between the solo songs because I think those are important. And the ones like Matthew where I really did want a band, but I didn't want it to interfere with the vocal or the song.
One of the amazing things, and people who are interested in the process of how songs come about, how they, what's the gestation period, how do they develop, and how do you come to a finished product?
Damned if I know.
Well, you have given us quite a guideline on the website.
On the
connected
making of a
with
CD,
this album.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about that.
I mentioned on my message board, I'm very active on my message board, and I get my own emails at the website, and I had mentioned a year and a half ago that we were starting to think about the new album. And I said a couple of things like, you know, we're going to be doing the tracking and then the overdubbing. And I got this slew of messages saying, what's tracking? What's overdubbing? Why are you allowing 3 months to do an album? Surely you just go in and you play all the songs and then it's done, isn't it? And so I got the idea to kind of let them in on it. And at the same time, we were going through this whole downloading discussion where I'm a big believer in downloading being a good thing and good for the music industry in general. And obviously that's made me pretty unpopular in certain quarters where they prefer to arrest 12-year-olds for doing it. But enough about that. So I decided, along with Tina Abbato, who runs my website, that we were going to try something that no one had ever tried. We were going to take the CD from square one, meaning from the first day that I put down the roughest version of the first song, right up through showing them all the drafts of the songs, giving them JPEGs that they could download, to allowing them to download the first version, the next version, the next version, right on up to the final versions of four songs. To stuff like our week five, because it's divided into 6 weeks, is Dolly Week. And Dolly very graciously let us tape the entire session and all the chit-chat that went on. So we've got Dolly saying, well, I am a very good singer. You know, I'm not really educated, but I'm going to do my best for you. You know, and it's just turned into this really wonderful look at everything from we show them the budget and what things cost, you know, and talk about in a daily diary, well, we can't get this musician here, so we've had to sub out this person, and, well, Dolly's going to have to be a day late, so there goes that part of the budget. We're going to have to take it from the catering. And I think it really gives people an overview of just how hard we work, you know, because at the end of the day, when somebody buys it and they listen to it 45 minutes or 60 minutes later, it's done. And they've listened to the whole thing.
It's not 60 minutes of work.
Right, and they're not seeing that the first song for this album was actually written 10 years ago. And that one of the songs on this album went through 23 drafts before I was satisfied, or that we really did literally spend 12 weeks making this tiny little disc, you know. So it's a great thing for the audience. It's a great thing for me. And I've actually been hearing from a lot of music industry people who are saying, oh, my God, I'm a lawyer and I never knew all this went into it. You know, so it's a cool thing to do.
Janicean.com, and people can view there exactly what is going on.
And download things for free and legal.
Now, you mentioned a name there that features on the album. You kept mentioning Dolly. I'm listening to, if you want to put on your headphones, you'll hear this a bit clearer. My Tennessee Hills is just starting off here in the background. Tell us how the Dolly Parton collaboration came about.
Well, I finished this song and I played it for Pat, my partner, and she said, oh, you've got to get Dolly to sing on it. And I said, right, Fat Chance. And she said, well, you know, it doesn't cost anything to ask. And it was great because we asked her producer to get her the music. And apparently she said her managers brought it in and they gave it to her and they said, we'll just tell her you can't do it, you're too busy. And she said, well, it's a Janice Ian song, so I think I'm going to listen. And, you know, you could just see the steel in her when she said that to me. And then she said that she listened to it, and they said, right now we'll tell her that you're too busy because you really just don't have time. And she said, well, we're going to make time because this is a great song by a great writer, and I want to sing on it. You know, and I sat there and I thought, wow. Dolly Parton told her management, too bad, I'm singing on it.
And here's what happened.
She still calls my name. I'll go home.
Dolly Parton and Janice Ian, My Tennessee Hills. She's in all of the choruses, Janice, she appears.
She's in every chorus, and on the website. It's great because you hear her just talking about and us joking and her saying, you were born on a farm? I didn't know they had farms in New Jersey. She's just great.
And also on that website, on the janiceaden.com, on the explanation of how the album came about, we hear all of, or sorry, maybe we don't hear all of them, we hear a lot of your conversations in the studio with her.
Yeah, yeah. There's about 20 minutes worth of us just talking about the song and the rehearsals for the song. I mean, she walked in knowing it dead cold. But then there's always changes when you put the two voices together and you see, oh, that doesn't really work. Oh, this works great. Let's keep that. You know, again, it's a big perk to me to be able to do something like that. And it was funny because when we posted on her website and my website that we were doing a duet, everybody was going, oh, is Janice Ian becoming a country singer? And it's funny because I just don't see music that way. I just see it as music. And this was a great opportunity to make some good music.
Why do people insist on putting those adjectives? Is she becoming a country singer?
It's a sales device, you know. Yeah, it's like my partner always says, I hate jazz. And I always go, but you love Billie Holiday. And she goes, but she's not jazz, is she? You know, it's the human need to slot things.
And it's just an ease when you go into a record shop, then you know what section to go to.
I guess, but wouldn't it be so much nicer if they just say, right, here's singers. Here's instrumentalists, here's singers you probably like, here's singers who suck. You know, it'd be much easier that way.
And there are other collaborations on the new album, Billy's Bones, as well. There are other
sort
of co-writes.
Oh, co-writes,
as
right.
you've referred
Sorry.
To them.
I was thinking, God, there's not another singer in there that I've forgotten to mention, was there? No, there's a Skip Ewing co-write. He's a really wonderful writer. There's I Hear You Sing Again, which is a Woody Guthrie co-write, which is really cool. Yeah.
I know that we're going to hear that, but we'll leave that just for, we'll come to that just before the end of the program, because I want to hear you sing to send me off into slumberland this
slumberland.
Afternoon. Writing. We mentioned your poem that's at the back of the CD notes on this, that poetry was there from teenage years.
Good thing I didn't become a poet, isn't it?
I don't Save know about that. I mean, grief. I should actually. I wonder, would you read a little bit of it for us? Would you read?
No. Please don't make me do that. No.
Is this like asking you to sing in front of your cousins?
Oh my God, no.
Well, listen,
it's tragic.
But tell us about the publication of the first book. That's a little while back now, isn't it? 2000. Recently, you had a book published.
I did actually last year. 2000. I had a reissue of the poetry book. Who Really Cares? And that's been published with all the missing poems. There were six that the editors felt were just a little too inflammatory. One was a poem to a girl, and they said, oh, no, 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 no. And then there was this Billie Holiday one, and then another one. I can't even remember what they were, but I dug them all out and put it in the new edition, so I thought that was pretty cool. And then last year, I was home for most of the year and did three projects. I did the live double CD and Billy's Bones, the new CD. But I also got to put together a science fiction anthology of stories by all my favorite authors based on my songs. So that was a very cool thing, and that's called Stars.
And science fiction, does that date back to your dad? He was
a great lover of that. You are entirely too well educated. This is worrisome. Yeah, my dad was a huge science fiction reader. You know, all those terrible pulp magazines with the naked woman being clutched by a green, hairy, tentacled monster. I mean, he just loved it. And my mom was big on that and mysteries, so I grew up on that. So when I started meeting these writers, like Orson Scott Card, you know, had been my heroes for 15, 20, some of them 30 years, it was just a huge thing for me. And then when Mike Resnick, my co-editor, said, let's do a book based on your songs, and I said, yeah, right, nobody will want to do that. And he said, well, I've already got five of your favorite writers who said yes. So if you'll give me the go-ahead and a list, we'll keep going. And it was great. We've got 22 stories in there, plus one of mine. So it's pretty cool.
And the sort of autonomy that you've managed now with the new album, you know, it's your own, you've made this yourself, essentially.
I either rise or fail at this point on my own decisions, yeah.
And you said about the lost poems. Has it annoyed you over the years the number of times you've had to kowtow to other people's decisions?
I don't think so, because the way that I figure it now, I mean, and some of it is so absurd, you know, like I go back to not being allowed to wear pants on television and having to change into a dress, not being allowed to play guitar on a session because girls didn't play guitar. With hindsight, it was so stupid. And yet somebody had to fight those battles, you know, somebody had to make the arguments. And fortunately or unfortunately, I was the one a lot of the time who got stuck on the front lines, for better or for worse. I mean, it's not something that I'm proud of and not something I'm ashamed of. It's just the way it washed out. In terms of kowtowing, I think I've had to do a lot less of that than other artists because I became pretty savvy pretty young, and I always had some good people around me watching out for me. So I did wind up owning most of my songs, and at this point I own a lot of my back catalog, the masters, to the point where I can afford to make an album the way that I want with my own money and then lease it.
And that's all been, the back catalogue has been reissued recently, hasn't it?
It is being reissued in this territory by Cooking Vinyl, who seem to be doing a very good job of it. And it's a great thing, you know, to be able to say to a record company, hey, I can offer you 16 albums and in return you'll help me fund this next album.
You're talking about that savvy gained very young. the harpsichord introduction.
Oh, I love that introduction. Artie Butler, that's great.
And you'd thought about that for months and months beforehand, Janice, hadn't you?
Well, actually, the producer asked me a few days before the session what I wanted to rent in the way of instruments, and I, not knowing you could rent instruments, thought, well, I'll never get to play harpsichord. So I said, can you rent me a harpsichord? And he said, why? And I said, for the intro. And then I went home thinking, oh my God, I've got to write an intro. So I did. I sat down and made up this little intro. And it was great at the session because the keyboard player, Artie Butler, was playing harpsichord and organ, which are on opposite sides of the room. So you had to run back and forth between the two, between the choruses and the verses. And it became this great laugh of watching him trying to get to one. Yeah, that was good.
I love the story that you sort of had to run off and do it after you said you wanted it.
I did. You know, well, who knew? I mean, I was 14. Who knew that they could even rent you a harpsichord?
Briefly, tell us a bit about the Pearl Foundation.
My mom had multiple sclerosis, and when we realized that she would never be able to go to work again, my brother and I talked her into going back to college. And I funded it. I was having a hit record at the time. And she got her BA and then her master's degree. And to the day she died, those stood right next to the pictures of her kids. When she died, I wanted to pay homage to her. And so we held an internet auction. This is pre-eBay. This is way before anybody was doing this. And we put 300 items up for sale, hoping to raise $15,000. And we raised $73,000, enough to fund 6 perpetual scholarships. And people kept sending money. And we kept sending it back, and they would send it back to us and say, no, donate this. Oh. So we finally became an IRS-approved charity organization. And we're very small. I mean, we have a tip jar at the shows, you know, and people send me money on my birthday. But we've got $116,000 now, and we've got 14 scholarship graduates so far. So it's a pretty cool thing.
And again, details of that, if people go onto your website, there's a link directly
to it.
Oh,
they can read all about it.
They can find out about it. The final song you're going to sing for us from the album?
Right. This is the song that, I sort of wrote with Woody Guthrie, I guess.
If I could only hear my mother sing again, if I could close my eyes and hear your voices then, all the friends and family would sing along with me and set your spirit free. In my heart I hear you sing again. Every note as natural as then. When I sing those songs for family and friends, in my heart I hear your voice again. I know the troubled times that turned your hair to gray, and all the tears and sorrows followed to your grave. Deep within the heart of hunger, there were always melodies passed from you to me. In my heart, I hear you sing again. Every note as natural as then. When I sing those songs for family and friends, in my heart I hear you sing again. And it's a long, long road I've come since my mother's songs were heard. But the child I can't outrun still hangs on every word. In my heart I hear you sing again. Every note as natural as then. And when I sing those songs for family and friends, in my heart I hear your voice again. Thank you.
I hear you sing again from Janice Ian's new album, Billy's Bones. Thank you for reawakening old memories and giving me a whole lot of new ones. Janice, thank you very much
Great
for playing
pleasure.
With us this afternoon. Today's programme was produced by Angus McAnally. Pat Ryan was on sound. I'm Sean Rocks. Goodbye.
That was Janice Ian talking to Sean Rocks from March 2004. The series producer of Drama on One is Kevin Reynolds.
Drama on One.
Sundays at 8 p.m.
rte.ie/drama on one.
Drama on One.